sat back, fists thrust into the pockets of her coat, and stared out at the passing street.
"You might see if Brianna will go with you," she said casually.
"She said she isn't having anything to do with this," Roger objected.
Claire glanced at him impatiently. The sun was setting behind her, and it made her eyes glow amber like a wolf's.
"In that case, I suggest you don't tell her what you're up to," she said, in a tone that made Roger remember that she was chief of staff at a large hospital.
His ears burned, but he stubbornly said,
"You can't very well hide it if you and I..."
"Not me," Claire interrupted. "You! I have something else to do."
This was too much, Roger thought. He pulled the car over without signalling and skidded to a stop at the side of the road. He glared at her.
"Something else to do, have you?" he demanded. "I like that. You're landing me with the job of trying to entice a drunken sot who will likely assault me on sight and luring your daughter along to watch. What, do you think she'll be needed to drive me to hospital after Edgar's has finished beating me over the head with a bottle?"
"No," Claire said, ignoring his tone. "I think you and Greg Edgar's together may succeed where I couldn't in convincing Bree that Gillian Edgar's is the woman I knew as Gilles Duncan."
"She won't listen to me."
"She likely won't listen to you either if you try to tell her what we found at the Institute today. But she'll listen to Greg Edgar's."
Her tone was flat and grim, and Roger felt his annoyance ebbing slightly. He started the car once more and pulled out into the stream of traffic.
"All right, I'll try," he said grudgingly, not looking at her. "And just where are you going to be while I do this?"
There was a small shuffling movement alongside as she groped in her pocket again. Then she drew out her hand and opened it. His eye caught the silvery gleam of a small object in the darkness of her palm. A key.
"I'm going to burgle the Institute," she said calmly. "I want that notebook."
After Claire excused herself to run her unspecified errand, making Roger shudder only slightly, he and Brianna had driven to the pub, but then decided to wait for their supper, since the evening was unexpectedly fine. They strolled down the narrow walk by the River Ness, and he had forgotten his misgivings about the evening in the pleasure of Brianna's company. They talked carefully at first, avoiding anything controversial. Then the chat turned to Roger's work, and grew gradually more animated.
"And how do you know so much about it anyway?"
Roger demanded, breaking off in the middle of a sentence.
"My father taught me," she replied.
At the word father, she stiffened a bit, and drew back as though expecting him to say something.
"My real father," she added pointedly.
"Well, he certainly knew," Roger replied mildly, leaving the challenge strictly alone.
"Plenty of time for that later, my girl," he thought cynically. "But it isn't going to be me that springs the trap."
Just down the street, Roger could see a light in the window of the Edgar's house. The quarry was denned then. He felt an unexpected surge of adrenaline at the thought of the coming confrontation. Adrenaline lost out to the surge of gastric juices that resulted when they stepped into the pub's savoury atmosphere, redolent of shepherd's pie. Conversation was general and friendly, with an unspoken agreement to avoid any reference to the scene at the manse the day before. Roger had noticed the coolness between Claire and her daughter before he had left her at the cab stand on their way to the pub. Seated side by side in the back seat, they had reminded him of two strange cats, ears laid flat and tails twitching, but both avoiding the eye-locking stare that would lead to claws and flying fur. After dinner, Brianna fetched their coats while he paid the bill.
"What's that for?" she asked, noticing the bottle of whiskey in his hand. "Planning a rave-up for later on?"
"Rave-up?" he said, grinning at her.
"You are getting on, aren't you? And what else have you picked up in your linguistic studies?"
She cast her eyes down in exaggerated demureness.
"Oh, well, there's a dance in the States called the Shag. I gather I shouldn't ask you to do it with me here, though."
"Not unless you mean it," he said.
They both laughed, But he thought the flush on her cheeks had deepened, and he was conscious of a certain stirring at the suggestion that made him keep his coat hung over one arm instead of putting it on.
"Well, after enough of that stuff, anything's possible," she said, indicating the whiskey bottle with a mildly malicious smile. "Terrible taste, though."
"It's acquired, lassie," Roger informed her, letting his accent broaden. "Only Scots are born with it. I'll buy you a bottle of your own to practice with. This one's a gift, though, something I promised to leave off. Want to come along, or shall I do it later?" he asked.
He didn't know whether he wanted her to come or not, but felt a surge of happiness when she nodded and shrugged into her own coat.
"Sure, why not?"
"Good." He reached out and delicately turned down the flap of her collar so it lay flat on her shoulder.
"It's just down the street. Let's walk, shall we?"
The neighbourhood looked a little better at night. Some of its shabbiness was hidden by the darkness, and the lights glowing from windows into the tiny front gardens gave the street an air of cosiness that it lacked during the day.
"This won't take a minute,"
Roger told Brianna as he pressed the buzzer. He wasn't sure whether to hope he was right or not. His first fear passed as the door opened. Someone was home and still conscious. Edgar's had plainly spent the afternoon in the company of one of the bottles lined up along the edge of the sway-backed buffet visible behind him. Luckily, he appeared not to connect his evening visitors with the intrusion of the afternoon. He squinted at Roger's introduction, composed on the way to the house.
"Gilly's cousin? I didn't know she had a cousin." "Well, she has," said Roger, boldly taking advantage of this admission. "I'm him."
He would deal with Gillian herself when he saw her, if he saw her. Edgar's blinked once or twice, then rubbed an inflamed eye with one fist, as though to get a better look at them. His eyes focused with some difficulty on Brianna, hovering diffidently behind Roger.
"Who's that?" he demanded.
My girlfriend," Roger improvised.
Brianna narrowed her eyes at him but said nothing. Plainly she was beginning to smell a rat, but went ahead of him without protest as Greg Edgars swung the door wider to admit them. The flat was small and stuffy, over-furnished with second-hand furniture. The air reeked of stale cigarettes and insufficiently taken-out garbage, and the remnants of takeaway meals were scattered heedlessly over every horizontal surface in the room. Brianna gave Roger a sidelong look that said,
"Nice relatives you have,"
and he shrugged slightly.
"Not my fault."
The woman of the house was plainly not at home, and hadn't been for some time. Or not in the physical sense, at least. Turning to take the chair Edgar's offered him, Roger came face to face with a large studio photograph, framed in brass, standing in the centre of the tiny mantelpiece. He bit his tongue to stifle a startled exclamation. The woman seemed to be looking out of the photograph into his face, a slight smile barely creasing the corner of her mouth. Wings of platinum fair hair fell thick and glossy past her shoulders, framing a perfect heart-shaped face. Eyes deep green as winter moss glowed under thick dark lashes.
"Good likeness, isn't it?"
Greg Edgars looked at the photo, his expression one of mingled hostility and longing.
Yes. Just like her."
Roger felt a little breathless and turned to remove a crumpled fish and chips paper from his chair. Brianna was staring at the portrait with interest. She glanced from the photo to Roger and back, clearly drawing comparisons.
"Cousins, was it?" "I take it Gillian's not here."
Roger started to wave away the bottle Edgar's had tilted inquiringly in his direction, then changed his mind and nodded. Perhaps a shared drink would gain Edgar's confidence. If Gillian wasn't here, he needed to find out where she was. Occupied in removing the excise seal with his teeth, Edgar shook his head, then delicately plucked a bit of wax and paper off his lower lip.
"Not hardly, mate. It's not quite so much a slum as this when she's here."
A sweeping gesture took in the overflowing ashtrays and tumbled paper drinks cups.
Close, maybe, but not quite this bad.
He took down three wine glasses from the china cupboard, peering dubiously into each one as though checking for dust. He poured the whiskey with the exaggerated care of the very drunk, taking the glasses one by one across the room to his guests. Brianna accepted hers with equal care, but declined a chair, instead leaning gracefully against the corner of the china cabinet. Edgar's plumped at last onto the rump-sprung sofa, ignoring the debris, and raised his glass.
"Cheers, mate,"
he said briefly, and took a long, slurping gulp.
"What'd you say your name is?"
he demanded, emerging abruptly from his immersion.
"Oh, Roger, right? Gilly never mentions you." "Then she wouldn't," he added moodily. "Never knew nothing about her family, and she wasn't a seeing. Think she was ashamed of them all. But you don't look such a Nelly," he said generously. "Your lass is a looker, at least." "Aye, that sounds right, eh? Your lass is a looker, at least. Hear that, eh?"
He laughed uproariously, spraying whiskey droplets.
"Yeah," said Roger. "Thanks."
He took a small sip of his drink. Brianna, offended, turned her back on Edgar's and affected to be examining the contents of the china closet through the bevel-cut glass doors. There seemed no point in beating around the bush, Roger decided. Edgar's wouldn't recognise subtlety if it bit him on the bum at this point, and there seemed a substantial danger that he might pass out soon at the rate he was going.
"Do you know where Gillian is?" he asked bluntly.
Every time he said her name, it felt strange on his tongue. This time he couldn't help glancing up at the mantelpiece where the photo smiled serenely on the debauch below. Edgar shook his head, swinging it slowly back and forth over his glass like an ox over a corn crib. He was a short, heavy-set man, about Roger's age, perhaps, but looking older because of the heavy growth of unshaved beard and dishevelled black hair.
"Nah," he said. "Thought maybe you knew. It'll be the gnats or the roses likely, but of no kip-up. I couldn't see who specially."
"Gnats?" Roger's heart began to speed up. "You mean the Scottish Nationalists?" Edgar's eyelids were beginning to droop, but they blinked open once more.
"Oh, aye, bloody gnats. Swear I met Gilly, aye."
"When was this, Mr. Edgar's?" Roger looked up in surprise at the soft voice from above. It wasn't the photograph that had spoken, though, but Brianna, looking intently down at Greg Edgar's. Roger couldn't tell whether she was merely making conversation or if she suspected something. Her face showed nothing beyond polite interest.
"Dunno. Maybe 2-3 years gone. Fun at first, Toss the bloody English out, join the common market on our own. Beer in the pub and a cuddle in the back of the van coming home from rallies.
Edgar shook his head again, dreamy-eyed at the vision. Then the smile faded from his face, and he frowned into his drink.
"That's before she went potty." "Potty?"
Roger took another quick glance at the photo. Intense, yes, she looked that. But not barking mad, surely. Or could you tell from a photo?
"Aye. Society of the White Rose. Charlie's my darling, will you no come back again and all that rot. Lot of jimmies dressed up in kilts and full rig with swords and all. All right, if you like it, of course,"
he added, with a cock-eyed attempt at objectivity.
"But Gilly'd always take a thing too far. On and on about the bonny prince, and wouldn't it be a nice thing if he'd won the 45? Blokes in the kitchen till all hours drinking up the beer and arguing why he hadn't. In the Gaelic, too."
He rolled his eyes.
"Load of rubbish."
He drained his glass to emphasise this opinion. Roger could feel Brianna's eyes boring into the side of his neck like gimlets. He pulled at his collar to loosen it, though he wasn't wearing a tie, and his collar button was undone. I don't suppose your wife's also interested in standing stones, is she, Mr. Edgars? Brianna wasn't bothering a lot with the polite interest anymore. Her voice was sharp enough to cut cheese. The effect was largely wasted on Edgars.
Stones?
He seemed fuddled, and stuck a forefinger into one ear, screwing it in industriously, as though in hopes of improving his hearing.
The prehistoric stone circles, like the Claver Cairns, Roger offered, naming one of the more famous local landmarks. In for a penny, in for a pound, he thought, with a mental sigh of resignation.
Brianna was plainly never going to speak to him again, so he might as well find out what he could.
Oh, those!
Edgars uttered a short laugh.
Aye, and every other bit of old rubbish you could name. That's the last bit and the worst. Down at that institute day and night, spending all my money on courses. Courses! Make a cat laugh, aye. Fairy tales they teach 'em there. You'll learn nothing useful in that place, lass, I told her. Why not learn to type? Get a job if she's bored. So I told her. So she left,
he said morosely.
Not seen her in 2 weeks.
He stared into his wine glass as though surprised to find it empty.
Have another, he offered, reaching for the bottle.
But Brianna shook her head decidedly. Thanks, no. We have to be going, don't we, Roger? Seeing the dangerous glint in her eye, Roger wasn't at all sure that he wouldn't be better off staying to split the rest of the bottle with Greg Edgars. Still, it was a long walk home if he let Brianna take the car. He rose with a sigh and shook Edgar's hand in farewell. It was warm and surprisingly firm in its grip, if a trifle moist. Edgars followed them to the door, clutching the bottle by the neck. He peered after them through the screen, suddenly calling down the walk.
If you see Gilly, tell her to come home, eh?
Roger turned and waved at the blurry figure in the lighted rectangle of the door.
I'll try, he called, the words sticking in his throat.
They made it to the walk and half down the street toward the pub before she rounded on him.
What in bloody hell are you up to? She said.
She sounded angry, but not hysterical.
You told me you haven't any family in the Highlands, so what's all this about cousins? Who is that woman in the picture?
He looked round the darkened street for inspiration, but there was no help for it. He took a deep breath and took her by the arm.
Gilles Duncan, he said.
She stopped, stock still, and the shock of it jarred up his own arm. With great deliberation, she detached her elbow from his grip. The delicate tissue of the evening had torn down the middle.
Don't touch me, she said through her teeth. Is this something Mother thought up?
Despite his resolve to be understanding, Roger felt himself growing angry in return.
Look, he said, can you not think of anyone but yourself in this? I know it's been a shock to you. God, how could it not be? And if you cannot bring yourself even to think about it, well, I'll not push you to it. But there's your mother to consider. And there's me as well.
You? What have you got to do with it? It was too dark to see her face, but the surprise in her voice was evident. He hadn't meant to complicate matters further by telling her of his involvement, but it was clearly too late for keeping secrets. And no doubt Claire had seen that when she suggested his taking Brianna out this evening. In a flash of revelation, he realized for the first time just what Claire had meant. She did have one means of proving her story to Brianna, beyond question. She had Gillian Edgars, who had, perhaps, not yet vanished to meet her fate as Gilles Duncan, tied to a flaming stake beneath the rowan trees of Leoch. The most stubborn cynic would be convinced, he supposed, by the sight of someone disappearing into the past before their eyes. No wonder Claire had wanted to find Gillian Edgars. In a few words, he told Brianna his relationship with the would-be witch of Cranesmuir.
And so it looks like being my life
or hers, he ended, shrugging, hideously conscious of how ridiculously melodramatic it sounded.
Claire, your mother, she left it to me, but I thought I had to find her, at the least.
Brianna had stopped walking to listen to him. The dim light from a corner shop caught the gleam of her eyes as she stared at him.
"You believe it, then?" she asked.
There was no incredulity or scorn in her voice. She was altogether serious. He sighed and reached for her arm again. She didn't resist, but fell into step beside him.
"Yes," he said. "I had to." "You didn't see your mother's face when she saw the words written inside her ring. That was real. Real enough to break my heart."
"You'd better tell me," she said, after a short silence. "What words?"
By the time he had finished the story, they had reached the car park behind the pub.
"Well," Brianna said hesitantly, "if..."
She stopped again, looking into his eyes. She was standing near enough for him to feel the warmth of her breasts close to his chest, but he didn't reach for her. The Kirk of St. Kilda was a long way off, and neither of them wanted to remember the grave beneath the yew trees, where the names of her parents were written in stone.
"I don't know, Roger," she said, shaking her head.
The neon sign over the pub's back door made purple glints in her hair.
"I just can't. I can't think about it yet. But..."
Words failed her, but she lifted a hand and touched his cheek, light as the brush of the evening wind.
"I'll think of you," she whispered.
When you come right down to it, committing burglary with a key isn't really a difficult proposition. The chance that either Mrs. Andrews or Dr. McEwen was going to come back and cop me in the act were vanishingly small. Even if they had, all I would have to do is say that I'd come back to look for a lost pocketbook and found the door open. I was out of practice, but deception had at one point been second nature to me. Lying was like riding a bicycle, I thought. You don't forget how. So it wasn't the act of getting hold of Gillian Edgar's notebook that made my heart race and my breath sound loud in my own ears. It was the book itself. As Master Raymond had told me in Paris, the power and the danger of magic lie in the people who believe it. From the glimpse I had had of the contents earlier, the actual information written in this cardboard notebook was an extraordinary mishmash of fact, speculation, and flat-out fantasy that could be of importance only to the writer. But I felt an almost physical revulsion at touching it. Knowing who had written it, I knew it for what it likely was, a grimoire, a magician's book of secrets. Still, if there existed any clue to Gilles Duncan's whereabouts and intentions, it would be here. Suppressing a shudder at the touch of the slick cover, I tucked it under my coat, holding it in place with my elbow for the trip down the stairs. Safely out on the street, still I kept the book under my elbow, the cover growing clammy with perspiration as I walked. I felt as though I were transporting a bomb, something which must be handled with scrupulous carefulness in order to prevent an explosion. I walked for some time, finally turning into the front garden of a small Italian restaurant with a terrace near the river. The night was chilly, but a small electric fire made the terrace tables warm enough for use. I chose one and ordered a glass of Chianti. I sipped at it for some time, the notebook lying on the paper placemat in front of me, in the concealing shadow of a basket of garlic bread. It was late April, only a few days until May Day, the Feast of Beltane. That was when I had made my own impromptu voyage into the past. I supposed it was possible that there was something about the date, or just the general time of year. It had been mid-April when I returned. That made that eerie passage possible. Or maybe not. Maybe the time of year had nothing to do with it. I ordered another glass of wine.
It could be that only certain people had the ability to penetrate a barrier that was solid to everyone else. Something in the genetic makeup. Who knew? Jamie hadn't been able to enter it, though I could. And Gillis Duncan obviously had. Or would. Or wouldn't, depending. I thought of young Roger Wakefield and felt mildly queasy. I thought perhaps I'd better have some food to go with the wine. The visit to the Institute had convinced me that wherever Gillian Gillis was, she hadn't yet made her own fateful passage. Anyone who had studied the legends of the Highlands would know that the Feast of Beltane was approaching. Surely anyone planning such an expedition would undertake it then. But I had no idea where she might be if she wasn't at home. In hiding, performing some peculiar rite of preparation picked up from Fiona's group of neo-druids. The notebook might hold a clue, but God only knew. God only also knew what my own motives were in this. I had thought I did, but was no longer sure. Had I involved Roger in the search for Gillis because it seemed the only way of convincing Brianna? And yet, even if we found her in time, my own purpose would be served only if Gillian succeeded in going back, and thus in dying by fire. When Gillis Duncan had been condemned as a witch, Jamie had said to me, "Dinna grieve for her, Sassenach. She's a wicked woman." And whether she had been wicked or mad, it had made little difference at the time. Should I not have left well enough alone and left her to find her own fate? Still, I thought, she had once saved my life. In spite of what she was, would be, did I owe it to her to try to save her life? And thus, perhaps, doom Roger. What right did I have to meddle any further?
"It isna a matter of right, Sassenach," I heard Jamie's voice saying with a tinge of impatience. "It's a question of duty, of honour."
"Honour, is it?" I said aloud. "And what's that?" The waiter with my plate of tortellini portofino looked startled.
"Eh?" he said.
"Never mind," I said, too distracted to care much what he thought of me. "Perhaps you'd better bring the rest of the bottle." I finished my meal surrounded by ghosts. Finally, fortified by food and wine, I pushed my empty plate aside and opened Gillian Edgar's grey notebook. Chapter 49. Blessed are those. There's no place darker than a highland road in the middle of a moonless night. I could see the flash of passing headlights now and then, silhouetting Roger's head and shoulders in a sudden flare of light. They were hunched forward, as though in defence against oncoming danger. Bree sat hunched as well, curled into the corner of the seat beside me. We were all three self-contained, insulated from each other, sealed in small individual pockets of silence, inside the larger silence of the car and its rushing flight. My fists curled in the pockets of my coat, idly scooping up coins and small bits of debris, shredded tissue, a pencil stub, a tiny rubber ball left on the floor of my office by a small patient. My thumb circled and identified the milled edge of an American quarter, the broad embossed face of an English penny, and the serrated edge of a key, the key to Gillian Edgar's carol, which I had neglected to return to the Institute. I tried again to call Greg Edgar's just before we left the old manse. The phone had rung again and again without answer. I stared at the dark glass of the window beside me, seeing neither my own faint reflection nor the massy shapes of stone walls and scattered trees that rushed by in the night. Instead, I saw the row of books arranged on the carrel's single shelf in a line as neat as a row of apothecary's jars. And below, the notebook, filled with fine cursive script, laying out in strict order conclusion and illusion, mingling myth and science, drawing from learned men and legends, all of it based on the power of dreams. To any casual observer, it could be either a muddle of half-thought-out nonsense, or at best, the outline for a clever, silly novel. Only to me did it have the look of a careful, deliberate plan. In a parody of the scientific method, the first section of the book was titled Observations. It contained disjointed references, tidy drawings, and carefully numbered tables. The position of sun and moon on the Feast of Beltane was one, with a list of more than 200 paired figures laid out beneath. Similar tables existed for Hogmanay and Midsummer's Day, and another for Samhain, the Feast of All Hallows. The ancient feasts of fire and sun. And Beltane's sun would rise tomorrow. The central section of the notebook was titled Speculations. That was accurate, at least, I reflected wryly. One page had borne this entry in neat slanting script. The Druids burnt sacrificial victims in wicker cages shaped like men, but individuals were killed by strangling and the throat slit to drain the body of blood. Was it fire or blood that was the necessary element? The cold-blooded curiosity of the question brought Gilles Duncan's face before me clearly. Not the wide-eyed, straight-haired student whose portrait adorned the Institute, but the secretive, half-smiling fiscal's wife, 10 years older, versed in the uses of drugs and the body, who lured men to her purposes and killed without passion to achieve her ends. And the last few pages of the book, neatly labelled Conclusions, which had led us to this dark journey, on the eve of the Feast of Beltane. I curled my fingers around the key, wishing with all my heart that Greg Edgars had answered his phone. Roger slowed, turning onto the bumpy dirt lane that led past the base of the hill called Craignadun.
"I don't see anything," he said.
He hadn't spoken in so long that the statement came out gruffly, sounding belligerent.
"Well, of course not," Brianna said impatiently. "You can't see the stone circle from here."
Roger grunted in reply and slowed the car still more. Obviously, Brianna's nerves were stretched, but so were his own. Only Claire seemed calm, unaffected by the growing air of tension in the car.
"She's here," Claire said suddenly.
Roger slammed on the brakes so abruptly that both Claire and her daughter pitched forward, thumping into the back of the seat in front of them.
"Be careful, you idiot,"
Brianna snapped furiously at Roger. She shoved a hand through her hair, pushing it off her face with a quick, nervous gesture. A swallow ran visibly down her throat as she bent to peer through the dark window.
"Where?" she said.
Claire nodded ahead to the right, keeping her hands shoved deep into her pockets.
"There's a car parked just behind that thicket."
Roger licked his lips and reached for the door handle.
"It's Edgar's car. I'll go and look. You stay here."
Brianna flung her door open with a squeal of metal from the unoiled hinges. Her silent look of scorn made Roger flush red in the dim glow of the dome light overhead. She was back almost before Roger had gotten out of the car himself.
"No one there," she reported.
She glanced up at the top of the hill.
"Do you think?"
Claire finished buttoning up her coat and stepped into the darkness without answering her daughter's question.
"The path is this way," she said.
She led the way, perforce, and Roger, watching the pale form drift ghost-like up the hill ahead of him, was forcibly reminded of that earlier trip up a steep hill to St. Kilda's Kirkyard. So was Brianna. She hesitated, and he heard her mutter something angrily under her breath. But then her hand reached for his elbow and gave it a hard squeeze, whether as encouragement or as a plea for support, he couldn't tell. It encouraged him, in any case, and he patted the hand and tugged it through the curve of his arm. In spite of his general doubts and the undeniable eeriness of the whole expedition, he felt a sense of excitement as they approached the crest of the hill. It was a clear night, moonless and very dark, with no more than the tiny gleams of mica flecks in the starlight serving to distinguish the looming stones of the ancient circle from the night around them. The trio paused on the gently rounded top of the hill, huddling together like a misplaced flock of sheep. Roger's own breath sounded unnaturally loud to himself.
"This," said Brianna through her teeth, "is silly."
"No, it isn't," said Roger. He felt suddenly breathless, as though a constricting band had squeezed the air from his chest.
There's a light over there.
It was barely there, no more than a flicker that promptly disappeared, but she saw it. He heard the sharp intake of her breath.
Now what? Roger wondered. Ought they to shout? Or would the noise of visitors frighten their quarry into precipitate action? And if so, what action might that be?
He saw Claire shake her head suddenly, as though trying to dismiss a buzzing insect. She took a step back, away from the nearest stone, and blundered into him. He grabbed her by the arm, murmuring,
"Steady, steady there,"
as one might to a horse. Her face was a dim blur in the starlight, but he could feel the quiver that ran through her, like electricity through a wire. He stood frozen, holding her arm, stiff with indecision. It was the sudden stink of petrol that jerked him into motion. He was vaguely conscious of Brianna, head flung up as the smell met her nostrils, turning toward the north end of the circle. And then he had dropped Claire's arm and was through the surrounding bushes and the stones themselves, striding toward the center of the ring, where a hunched black figure made an ink blot on the lighter darkness of the grass. Claire's voice came from behind him, strong and urgent, shattering the silence. "Gillian," she called. There was a soft, sudden whoosh, and the night lit up in brilliance. Dazzled, Roger fell back a pace, stumbling and dropping to his knees. For a moment there was nothing but the sharp pain of light on his retinas and the blaze of brightness that hid everything behind it. He heard a cry beside him and felt Brianna's hand on his shoulder. He blinked hard, eyes streaming, and sight began to return. The slim figure stood between them and the fire, silhouetted like an hourglass. As his sight cleared, he realized that she was dressed in a long, full skirt and tight bodice, the clothes of another time. She had turned at the call, and he had a brief impression of wide eyes and fair, flying hair lifted and tossed in the hot wind of the fire. He found time, struggling to his feet, to wonder how she had dragged a log of that size up here. Then the smell of burned hair and crackled skin hit his face like a blow, and he remembered. Greg Edgars wasn't at home tonight. Not knowing whether blood or fire was a necessary element, she had chosen both. He pushed past Brianna, focused only on the tall, slim girl before him and the image of a face that mirrored his own. She saw him coming, turned, and ran like the wind for the cleft stone at the end of the circle. She had a knapsack of rough canvas slung over one shoulder. He heard her grunt as it swung heavily and struck her in the side. She paused for an instant, hand outstretched to the rock, and looked back. He could have sworn that her eyes rested on him, met his own, and held them beyond the barrier of the fire's blaze. He opened his mouth in a wordless shout. She whirled then, light as a dancing spark, and vanished in the cleft of the rock. The fire, the body, the night itself disappeared abruptly in a shriek of blinding noise. Roger found himself face down on the grass, clutching at the earth in frantic search of a familiar sensation to which to anchor his sanity. The search was in vain. None of his senses seemed to function. Even the touch of the ground was insubstantial, amorphous, as though he lay on quicksand, not granite. Blinded by whiteness, deafened by the scream of rending stone, he groped, flailing wildly out of touch with his own extremities, conscious only of an immense pull and the need to resist it. There was no sense of time passing. It felt as though he had been struggling in emptiness forever, when at last he became aware of something outside himself. Hands that gripped his arms with desperate strength, and the smothering softness of breasts thrust against his face. Hearing began gradually to return, and with it the sound of a voice calling his name. Calling him names, in fact, panting between phrases. "You idiot! You jerk! Wake up, Roger, you ass!" Her voice was muffled, but the sense of it reached him clearly. With a superhuman effort, he reached up and got hold of her wrists. He rolled, feeling ponderous as the start of an avalanche, and found himself blinking stupidly at the tear-streaked face of Brianna Randall, eyes dark as caves in the dying light of the fire. The smell of petrol and roasting flesh was overwhelming. He turned aside and gagged, retching heavily into the damp grass. He was too occupied even to be grateful that his sense of smell had returned. He wiped his mouth on his sleeve and groped unsteadily for Brianna's arm. She was huddled into herself, shaking.
"Oh, God," she said. "Oh, God, I didn't think I could stop you. You were crawling straight to it. Oh, God."
She didn't resist as he pulled her to him, but neither did she respond to him. She merely went on shaking, the tears running from wide, empty eyes, repeating, "Oh, God," at intervals, like a broken record.
"Hush," he said, patting her. "It'll be all right. Hush."
The spinning sensation in his head was easing, though he still felt as though he had been split into several pieces and scattered violently among the points of the compass. There was a faint, crackling pop from the darkening object on the ground, but beyond that, and Brianna's mechanical ejaculations, the stillness of the night was returning. He put his hands to his ears, as though to still the echoes of the killing noise.
"You heard it too?" he asked.
Brianna went on crying, but nodded her head, jerky as a puppet.
"Did your..."
he began, still laboriously assembling his thoughts piecemeal, then snapped upright as one came to him full-formed.
"Your mother!"
he exclaimed, gripping Brianna hard by both arms.
"Claire! Where is she?"
Brianna's mouth dropped open in shock, and she scrambled to her feet, wildly scanning the confines of the empty circle, where the man-high stones loomed stark, half-seen in the shadows of the dying fire.
"Mother!" she screamed. "Mother! Where are you?" "It's all right," Roger said, trying to sound authoritatively reassuring. "She'll be all right now."
In truth, he had no idea whether Claire Randall would ever be all right. She was alive, at least, and that was all he could vouch for. They had found her, senseless in the grass near the edge of the circle, white as the rising moon above, with nothing but the slow, dark seep of blood from her abraded palms to testify that her heart still beat. Of the hellish journey down the path to the car, her dead weight slung across his shoulder, bumping awkwardly as stones rolled under his feet and twigs snatched at his clothing, he preferred to remember nothing. The trip down the cursed hill had exhausted him. It was Brianna, the bones of her face stark with concentration, who had driven them back to the manse, hands clamped to the wheel like vices. Slumped in the seat beside her, Roger had seen in the rear-view mirror the last faint glow of the hilltop behind them, where a small, luminous cloud floated like a puff of cannon smoke, mute evidence of battle past. Brianna hovered now over the sofa, where her mother lay, motionless as a tomb figure on a sarcophagus. With a shudder, Roger had avoided the hearth where the banked fire lay sleeping, and had instead pulled up the small electric fire with which the Reverend had warmed his feet on winter nights. Its bars glowed orange and hot, and it made a loud, friendly whirring noise that covered the silence in the study. Roger sat on a low stool beside the sofa, feeling limp and starchless. With the last remnants of resolve, he reached toward the telephone table, his hand hovering a few inches above the instrument.
"Should we..."
he had to stop to clear his throat.
"Should we call a doctor? The police?"
"No." Brianna's voice was intent, almost absent-minded, as she bent over the still figure on the couch. "She's coming round." The domed eyelids stirred, tightened briefly in the returning memory of pain, then relaxed and opened. Her eyes were clear and soft as honey. They drifted to and fro, skimmed over Brianna, standing tall and stiff at his side, and fixed on Roger's face. Claire's lips were bloodless as the rest of her face. It took more than one try to get the words out in a hoarse whisper.
Did she go back?
Her fingers were twisted in the fabric of her skirt, and he saw the faint dark smear of blood they left behind. His own hands clutched instinctively on his knees, palms tingling. She had held on too, then, grappling among the grass and gravel for any small hold against the engulfment of the past. He closed his eyes against the memory of that pulling rupture, nodding.
Yes, he said. She went.
The clear eyes went at once to her daughter's face. Brows above them arched as though in question. But it was Brianna who asked.
It was true, then? She asked hesitantly. Everything was true?
Roger felt the small shudder that ran through the girl's body, and without thinking about it, reached up to take her hand. He winced involuntarily as she squeezed it, and suddenly in memory heard one of the Reverend's texts.
Blessed are those who have not seen and have believed.
And those who must see, in order to believe.
The effects of belief wrought by seeing trembled fearful at his side, terrified at what else must now be believed. Even as the girl tightened, bracing herself to meet a truth she had already seen, the lines of Claire's tensed body on the sofa relaxed. The pale lips curved in the shadow of a smile, and a look of profound peace smoothed the strained white face and settled glowing in the golden eyes.
"It's true," she said. A tinge of colour came back into the pallid cheeks. "Would your mother lie to you?"
And she closed her eyes once more. Roger reached down to switch off the electric fire. The night was cold, but he could stay no longer in the study, his temporary sanctuary. He still felt groggy, but he couldn't delay longer. The decision had to be made. It had been dawn before the police and the doctor had finished their work the night before, filling in their forms, taking statements and vital signs, doing their best to explain away the truth.
Blessed are they who have not seen, he thought again devoutly, but who have believed.
Especially in this case.
Finally they had left, with their forms and badges and cars with flashing lights, to oversee the removal of Greg Edgar's body from the Ring of Stone, to issue a warrant for the arrest of his wife, who, having lured her husband to his death, had fled the scene.
To put it mildly, Roger thought dazedly.
Exhausted in mind and body, Roger had left the Randalls to the care of the doctor and Fiona, and had gone to bed, not bothering to undress or turn back the quilts, merely collapsing into a welcome oblivion. Roused near sunset by gnawing hunger, he had stumbled downstairs to find his guests similarly silent, if less dishevelled, helping Fiona with the preparation of supper. It had been a quiet meal. The atmosphere wasn't strained. It was as though communication ran unseen among the people at the table. Brianna sat close to her mother, touching her now and then in the passing of food, as though to reassure herself of her presence. She had glanced occasionally at Roger, shy, small looks from beneath her lashes, but didn't talk to him. Claire said little, and ate almost nothing, but sat quite still, quiet and peaceful as a loch in the sun. Her thoughts turned inward. After dinner she had excused herself and gone to sit in the deep window seat at the end of the hall, pleading tiredness. Brianna had cast a quick glance at her mother, silhouetted in the last glow of the fading sun as she faced the window, and gone to help Fiona in the kitchen with the dishes. Roger had gone to the study, Fiona's good meal heavy in his stomach, to think. 2 hours later, he was still thinking, to remarkably little effect. Books were stacked untidily on the desk and table, left half open on the seats of chairs and the back of the sofa, and gaping holes in the crowded bookshelves testified to the effort of his haphazard research. It had taken some time, but he had found it. the short passage he remembered from his earlier search on Claire Randall's behalf. Those results had brought her comfort and peace. This wouldn't, if he told her. And if he were right. But he must be. It accounted for that misplaced grave so far from Culloden. He rubbed a hand over his face and felt the rasp of beard. Not surprising that he'd forgotten to shave, what with everything. When he closed his eyes, he could still smell smoke and blood, see the blaze of fire on dark rock and the strands of fair hair flying just beyond the reach of his fingers. He shuddered at the memory, and felt a sudden surge of resentment. Claire had destroyed his own peace of mind. Did he owe her any less? And Brianna, if she knew the truth now, should she not know all of it? Claire was still there at the end of the hall, feet curled under her on the window seat, staring out at the blank black stretch of the night-filled glass. Claire! His voice felt scratchy from disuse, and he cleared his throat and tried again. Claire, I have something to tell you. She turned and looked up at him, no more than the faintest curiosity visible on her features. She wore a look of calm, the look of one who has borne terror, despair, and mourning, and the desperate burden of survival, and has endured. Looking at her, he felt suddenly that he couldn't do it. But she had told the truth. He must do likewise.
I found something.
He raised the book in a brief, futile gesture.
About Jamie.
Speaking that name aloud seemed to brace him as though the big Scot himself had been conjured by his calling to stand solid and unmoving in the hallway between his wife and Roger. Roger took a deep breath in preparation.
What is it?
The last thing he meant to do. I think he failed.
Her face paled suddenly, and she glanced wide-eyed at the book. His men? But I thought you found...
I did, Roger interrupted. No, I'm fairly sure he succeeded in that. He got the men of Lallybroch out. He saved them from Culloden and set them on the road home.
But then...
He meant to turn back to the battle. And I think he did that, too.
He was increasingly reluctant, but it had to be said. Finding no words of his own, he flipped the book open and read aloud.
After the final battle at Culloden, 18 Jacobite officers, all wounded, took refuge in the old house, and for 2 days, their wounds untended, lay in pain. Then they were taken out to be shot. One of them, a Fraser of the Master of Lovett's regiment, escaped the slaughter. The others were buried at the edge of the domestic park. One man, a Fraser of the Master of Lovett's regiment, escaped, Roger repeated softly.
He looked up from the stark page to see her eyes, wide and unseeing as a deer's, fixed in the headlights of an oncoming car.
He meant to die on Culloden Field, Roger whispered. But he didn't.
The End. You've been listening to Dragonfly in Amber by Diana Gabaldon, narrated by Davina Porter. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, the story continues in Voyager, also by Diana Gabaldon and narrated by Davina Porter. You'll find a wide selection of titles, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more, in the Recorded Books catalogue. So to order another recorded book, or for a copy of our latest listing, call us toll-free nationwide at 1-800-638-1304. You can order by phone with Visa or MasterCard, or by writing to us, or by faxing us at 410-535-5499. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.